Omaha Public Radio presents a special program on Noon Forum. We'll hear the 18th Annual Governor's Lecture in the Humanities, presented by Humanities Nebraska, formerly the Nebraska Humanities Council, and the University of Nebraska. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Wednesday evening, October 30th, 2013, for broadcast at this time. Today's guest speaker will be Annette Gordon Reed, Charles Warren Professor of American Legal History at Harvard Law School, and author of The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family. She'll speak on the topic, The Most Blessed of Patriarchs, Thomas Jefferson and the Empire of Imagination. Following her lecture, Dr. Gordon Reed will be joined on stage by Peter Onuf, Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation Professor of History Emeritus at the University of Virginia, and a senior research fellow at the Robert H. Smith International Center for Jefferson Studies at Monticello. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of Humanities Nebraska, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Nebraska Governor Dave Heineman.
Annette Gordon Reed is a legal scholar and historian whose investigation into the life of Thomas Jefferson has had a dramatic impact on how we look at this iconic American president. One of her books earned her the Pulitzer Prize in History and the National Book Award for Nonfiction. She is the Charles Warren Professor of Legal History at Harvard Law School and a professor of history at Harvard University. Her many honors include a MacArthur Genius Fellowship, a Coleman Center Fellowship, a Guggenheim Fellowship, and a National Humanities Medal. Please join me in giving a warm Nebraska welcome to Annette Gordon Reed.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Governor Heineman, for that wonderful introduction. I have been greatly heartened by the warmth and the hospitality of the people of Nebraska. I've not been to Omaha before. My only other trip to Nebraska was to Lincoln, Nebraska, a couple of years ago. Some Lincoln fans. And upon my leaving, they gave me a red jersey. And so I figured that red might be appropriate to wear tonight, but people have been remarkably generous, and I'm very, very happy and honored to be here tonight on this event that is so historic for you and something that evidently the community supports very, very much. I also want to put in a plug myself. For the past couple of years, I've been on something called the National Commission on the Humanities, which was a commission that Senator Mark Warner and Senator Lamar Alexander asked the American Academy of Arts and Sciences to put together to try to make the case for the humanities. STEM and science, those kinds of things are very, very important to the United States, important to our country. But we wanted to make the case that people should not forget the humanities. And one of the things that we did in our meetings, and one of the things that we're going to continue to do after the issuance of our report, the heart of the matter, which I can get copies of you to, anybody who's interested, that makes a case for the humanities and talks about how vital it is for the American citizenry to know about history, to know about literature and culture. Those things are important, too, as important as science. Not against science, not against STEM, but all of this has to go together. And we're going to be working with Humanities Councils and hopefully Humanities Nebraska to put things together so that this message is sent out all throughout the community. So I'm very happy to be a part of this event that fits very nicely with something that I've been thinking about for the past 2 years. Now on to the topic of the night, Mr. Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson is an enigma. Well, he's seen as an enigma by many people, considered to be the most contradictory, is written of as one of the president of founding members of the generation who has so many more contradictions than others. We know about this because Jefferson left lots of records, many, many records, over 18,000 letters that he wrote, a memorandum book that I have used extensively in my own work that documents every single transaction he made during the day or from the time he was in his 20s until his 80s. If you could imagine going to Starbucks and buying something and you come back and you write down 360 for cappuccino on October 29th, 2013, that kind of thing. An enormous treasure trove of work, a farm book, a garden book, as I said, the memorandum books. He kept copies of all the letters he sent out and a record of when he sent them out and the letters as they came in. So this is a person who was an inveterate record keeper, and there's a lot of documentary evidence left about him. But people still see him as this enigma. Joseph Ellis has written of him as the American Sphinx, an incomprehensible person, impenetrable individual, despite all of these documents. People feel that you should know him because you have all of these records. And I've been interested in him for many years. My interest began as a child when I read a book about him in the third grade, and that launched my study of slavery and study of life at Monticello and studying Jefferson. And for a time, I sort of thought of him. I bought the idea that he was this, because of his contradictions, this person who could not be understood. My first book was an attempt to get a handle on how other historians had written about a particular question, and that is whether or not Jefferson had had a long-term liaison with a woman on his plantation named Sally Hemings. And I was writing more about historians, what they thought about this subject, but necessarily the question whether it was true or not entered the discussion. And I sort of came to a conclusion at the end of the book that it was likely that this story was true, but that was not the main point of my book. It was really about how the image of Jefferson, how historians had crafted a particular image of Jefferson, and how we viewed him. In the process of doing that, I got the idea that I really, at some point, wanted to do a biography of Jefferson. And I actually am going to be doing a biography of Jefferson, not the book that I'm working on with Peter that I'm going to talk about in a second, but a two-volume biography of Jefferson, because I think that in light of all that we know about him now, in light of all of the work that has been done on slavery at Monticello and slavery as an institution, that there's a way to write a new story of Jefferson that takes all of this into account and brings the whole man full, and we can get a true picture of him. And I wanted to do that. And in between getting to the biography of Jefferson, I wrote a book called The Hemingses of Monticello, which was really to try, and talked earlier today about wanting to master one particular area of Jefferson's life, and that is life at Monticello, life on the plantation, before I embarked upon a larger book, the book that was supposed to be the biography. It occurred to me that one of the ways that you learn a topic is to write a book about it, about a subject, not doing anything sort of in a, you know, not, you know, just wanting to be the obsessive compulsive person that I am, which sort of got me in this position where I have this cane, the bicycle, writing, and, you know, whatever it is, do it and do it to death. I thought the best thing to do would be to write a book about it and to learn about him, and I thought the best way to do that was with a co-author, with someone who, with whom I have had an intellectual engagement since the beginning of my career as a Jefferson scholar. My first book, Thomas Jefferson, Sally Hemings, An American Controversy, was published at the University Press of Virginia, largely at the with the urging of Peter Onuf, who you will hear from tonight as we are in conversation, to talk about our new book. Peter is an intellectual historian. I do social and cultural history and political history. We both write about the political life, Jefferson's political life. I thought that this would be a way to get into Jefferson, to talk about things or to learn about things that I knew things about, you know, sort of superficially. I know John Locke and Hume and all of the Montesquieu, the people who influenced him. I know what Jefferson wrote about a number of issues. But my focus was mainly on the day-to-day life, what he was doing, not as much about what he was thinking. And so I asked Peter, who is the Thomas Jefferson professor, Memorial Foundation professor at UVA. He's emeritus now, but now he's a senior scholar at the Robert H. Smith International Center for Jefferson Studies. I decided to ask him, why don't we collaborate on a book? This would be the book in and of itself, I think, would be good to try to push back on this notion of Jefferson as this impenetrable person, that, in fact, Jefferson can be known as much as any of us can be known. I mean, how you can't know everything about anybody just because he's not here and just because he left this voluminous body of information. It was wrong to think that you could ever know him completely. But I think you could know him as well as we could know anybody else. And I think that it was a valuable, we think it's a valuable thing to do, because so much of Jefferson's life, so many of the questions that were raised during his time, so many of the issues that he grappled with are things that we are thinking about today. Now, historians, you know, people are always concerned about this issue of presentism, of being anachronistic, or holding people to the standards of today. But the truth of the matter is most people are interested in history because they want to know how we got here. What does it mean to, you know, to me? I like history. I used to, when I grew up, I used to like to sort of go through old microfilms and look at and read old newspapers. Not to any particular end, but I was just interested in what people were doing in the past. Even whether it had anything specifically to do with me or not, but I think that there is an aspect of it for all of us that says, how are we here? Why do we have a problem of race? What about our political system? What do we think about federalism? What do we think about states' rights? What about the relationship between the federal government and the state government? What about the judiciary? Why is it that the court gets to decide whether something is unconstitutional? Why couldn't a president decide that? Why can't Congress decide? How do we get to this place? And Jefferson is a wonderful vehicle, I think. I don't know if that's sort of mercenary sounding, a vehicle, but he's a vehicle for discussing these kinds of issues because as the master of a slave plantation, he obviously, the question of slavery and its role in the history of the United States is implicated there. Race, he wrote Notes on the State of Virginia, in which he muses about the races, the differences in the races, in which he speculates that blacks may be inferior to whites. He talks about blacks' hearts, blacks emotionally. Blacks, at one point, he says, have the best hearts of any people in the world. But he was not so sure about their intellectual, our intellectual capabilities. That's a question that has bedeviled this issue of racism and white supremacy has bedeviled the United States from his time until now. He grappled with the question of whether or not we could have a multiracial society. He didn't think that blacks and whites could live together without turmoil, without an actual fight, a war, a race war. Whites would never give up their prejudices against blacks, and black people would never be able to forgive white people for the things that had been done to them as slaves. And we was talking to earlier today, talking with faculty and students about this question, Jefferson's attitude about race and black people's place in society. And one of the things that I said is that, you know, he brings out all of these issues very, very well. And we focus in on him because other members of the founding generation did not really write about this. We really don't know what George Washington felt about race. Because George Washington was not really given to musing about the future in the way that Jefferson was. He was much more recording his fox hunting episodes. And, you know, he talked about other things. I'm exaggerating, of course, but Jefferson is our philosophical president. And people made fun of him that way. Before that, his head sort of in the clouds, thinking about the future, seeing himself as a visionary. Not all of his visions came to pass, for good and ill, you know, for better or worse. I mean, some of them are good and some of them are bad. But that's his image, and that's the way he thought of himself, as a person who's thinking about the future. So he thought about, you know, what are we going to do? If you can imagine him sitting at Monticello, and he's surrounded by African-American people, and he's thinking about the future. You know, what is this country going to be like? And you look out the window, or he hears the sounds of people who have been enslaved. What are we going to do with these people? Can they be Republican citizens? Can we accept them as Republican citizens? That question was posed strongly in his day-to-day life, his existence, and it formed the way he thought about the world. I suggested earlier today that perhaps one of the reasons, this may not be fair, but I'm going to say it anyway, John Adams has become such a subject of fascination. Not that he's not a fascinating person in some ways, just not as fascinating as Jefferson, is because his story is much, it's cleaner in the sense that you don't have to grapple with all of these issues. You know, slavery, you don't have to grapple with it. Adams did not have to grapple with slavery in the manner that Jefferson did. He didn't have to grapple with race in the manner that Jefferson did. So all of these things are there, present in this person. And when we write about him, we are in some ways, I mean, for me, it's asking this question, again, trying to answer this question, how did we get here through the life of this particular person? So Peter and I are going to try to make him as coherent as possible. We are going to suggest that this habit, I think we have, of separating Jefferson out, the public Jefferson and the private Jefferson, as two distinct things, is problematic. I think that too was convenient for historians, because the private life, in some ways, we now know, was problematic. Not just the Hemings question, but when people began to think more about women, for example, the Jefferson's relationships with women, with his daughters, what we would call today a sort of patriarchal attitude about women, this caused discomfort for people. People began to sort of move away from assuming that this was a happy family and the way people, you know, posit, the way the historians posited it as a happy family. We began to see, you know, is this just love of his daughters? Is this control? I mean, we wanted a more, people began to take a more realistic view of him in that area. So it's not just race, but it's the issue of Jefferson and women. And what is going on privately was sort of cordoned off. Peter and I want to talk about how Jefferson's private understanding of family really radiates out to Jefferson, the public person. He saw the United States as sort of a larger construction of a family, sort of a larger iteration of this notion of family. A Republican family to a Republican local community to a Republican nation. So if you understand how he thinks about family, you understand how he comes to a particular configuration, what he thinks is the best configuration of a nation. So the public-private distinction we try to collapse. The title of the book, Most Blessed of the Patriarchs, Thomas Jefferson and the Empire of the Imagination, our publishers is kind of pushing back on the Empire of the Imagination because they don't think it, people don't really know what it, that means, but I mean, obviously the book is trying to tell people what that means, but you know, marketing people have their own, I mean, you know, it's just hard to argue with marketing people about stuff, but I think we got some, you know, once people, we talked to people about it, we got some positive feedback from people here in Omaha, and I'm told that Omaha is a place where people test out, do a lot of market testing, and in fact, it was very positive. So we're going to carry this message back to W.W. Norton and say, you know, people in Omaha like Empire of the Imagination, so we're going to stick with that. But the first part of it, the most blessed of the patriarchs, comes from a letter that Jefferson wrote after he is leaving, he's decided to leave his position as Secretary of State. I suppose many of you know that his great rival was Alexander Hamilton, who was in the cabinet with him at that time, and they were sort of at each other's throats. He said they were pitted at each other like two cocks, you know, like they were fighting. Hamilton won, essentially, that round. He doesn't win the end, but he won that particular battle for Washington's favor. And Jefferson is going home to lick his wounds and saying, you know, he's taking his marbles and going home. I'm never going to be, I'm out of public life forever. And there's some real question about whether or not he actually believed that. Some people say that he had come home for good, and I'm not so certain. It's hard for me to imagine that he could ever have really walked away from that when he thought that there was any danger. He actually saw Hamilton and his crew as an affirmative danger to the revolution that he had devoted his life to. So I don't really think he was going to go away forever. But he goes back, and he's writing this letter to her, and he describes himself sort of talking about what's going on in his family, that his daughters have been married, and if his elder daughter had been married, if his younger daughter gets married, then he will be content. He will be the most blessed of the patriarchs. And that's a great phrase, because you think of this individual who, at the time that he's writing this, is thought of as a Jacobin. He is still supporting the French Revolution at that time, and he already knew that they sort of gone off the rails killing people and heads on poles, the whole business, and yet he was still supporting it. So here's a guy who sees himself, who is seen as by other people and still has the air of the, you know, the revolutionary about him, that, you know, he reacts with equanimity to the killing of the royal couple. He says, basically, you know, why should their deaths matter more than the deaths of other people? You know, so this is, he's kind of out there. But he describes himself as the most blessed of patriarchs. And when you hear the word patriarch, what do you think? You think of somebody from olden times, you know, a guy with, you know, a wife and concubines, and, well, he had the concubine, but the children and all these kinds of things that are old world, that are retrogressive, that are backwards. But he sees himself as a patriarch. And part of what we're going to do in this book is to, as historians like to say, unpack, you know, what the heck is up with that? You know, you're this patriarch, you're this Republican patriarch. How does that work? And we think we've found out how to do that, to talk about that in a way that explicates Jefferson in a manner that I don't, in a way that I don't think others have done before. So there's this issue of Jefferson's image of himself. That's what the empire of the imagination, how he constructs his world at Monticello, and how that influences the way he sees the world at large. And he honestly believed that the experiment that was taking place in the United States, the Republican experiment, would spread across the country, would be taken up by people in the country. And he really feels that, you know, he really felt when he was elected in 1800 that that was a renewal. It sort of vanquished Hamilton and his forces, that crowd, and that, in fact, this Republican Revolution would spread all over the world, that everybody would be, that the progress meant, he was the man of the Enlightenment, and for him, progress meant republicanism, people, the will of the people being expressed through the people who, you know, their representatives, and everybody had a say in government. So the empire of the imagination is how he imagines this world coming about. And what was the source of all of that? What are the forces that went into making him the man that he was and made him the leader that he was and to have the kind of hopes for the country that he had? And so that's what we're trying to do with this. One other point that I wanted to talk about is this issue of the issue of religion, a subject that Peter has brought to fore and developing an argument about Jefferson's religious attitude and how all of this fits into it. Jefferson is seen as a person, well, this great controversy about Jefferson and religion. I mentioned earlier today that in my home state of Texas, there are people who want to take him out of the history books because he's not, you can imagine, you know, the person who wrote the Declaration of Independence for America, not in history books, in American history books. I mean, if he's not in American history books, nobody should be in American history books. Whatever you think about him, I mean, you just can't, that's just crazy. But that's Texas, and I love Texas, you know. I mean, I hasten to add, I mean, I do love Texas. I love my home state. I'm always explaining it to people. Now you have to understand that blah, 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 and I have to go through this. But because of his religious beliefs or people's understanding about him, I mean, he's a controversial figure, and we're going to talk about that, about how that fits into this picture of his imagination and what he's imagining for the country as a whole. So I've been very much heartened by this experiment that Peter and I, this journey that we've been on. We're supposed to deliver this optimistically at the end of December. I'm going to be working like a mad woman to make that happen, but it's fun. It has been fun, and it's. I can't imagine people doing this kind of work and doing the kind of work that I've done before without actually loving doing the work. It's more a joy for me than actually a chore. And this journey has been very much enlightening to me. And the end result will be a book and a launching pad for another book, which is always what books are about. And I'm hoping the books will always be about for me. And we hope that we say something about Jefferson that is new and unique. And I think we have it. He is an understandable person. He is a person who can be known, and it's important to understand him. It's not just what the famous Parton quote, you know, if America is right, Jefferson was right. I'm probably getting this wrong. If Jefferson was wrong, America was wrong, or whatever. We're not collapsing him into that formulation. But there is something to the notion that we can know something about ourselves by looking at his life. And that's what propelled me to this subject. It's sort of an odd interest. People wonder how an African-American woman becomes a Jefferson scholar. I don't think there are any others that I know of. But it's not the story of... Jefferson is not the story of white people. Jefferson is the story of all Americans. And that's what I've tried to show with my work, and that's what it's been my privilege to do. And so I think we're running behind, so I should get to talking with Peter about what we're doing and take your questions. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Annette. I'm Will Thomas, and I'm going to moderate a little discussion with Peter and Annette. And I'm actually going to, in the interest of time, not introduce Peter elaborately. He's already been introduced. He is most well known as 18th century guy on the Backstory radio show from the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. If you've not heard of it, I would encourage you to find it online, listen to Backstory on podcasts or online. But we're going to go right to question.
I'm just a radio star?
You are a radio star. I want to start, Peter, I want to ask you about Jefferson's world, and if you could just talk with us about how the world of Jefferson was changing in the late 18th century. You've written a lot about this. So what are the big changes in Jefferson's life?
Well, Will, it's a wonderful question. And have you got an hour or so? One word says it all, and that's revolution.
Yeah.
And the thing that changes is, as Will's question suggests, his world, and that world is the world of the British Empire. There's a big debate among scholars about whether America is an empire, and it's really about how we use collectively our power in the world today, and it's usually deployed in a pejorative sense. Empire is bad. But Jefferson was an imperialist, and this is the thing to keep in mind, because he saw, as a loyal subject of King George III, that the British Empire was the greatest empire in world history to that time, and it was an empire for liberty. It wasn't the empire that emerged in the imagination of American revolutionaries, which is the epitome of despotism, now known as Washington, D.C. I don't believe that, but that's what he said. I think a lot of Jefferson's life has to do with his trying to explain himself to himself and to his colleagues and to his countrymen what had happened, what had changed, why did we suddenly find ourselves an independent country? Where did that idea of equality come from when everybody knows that all men are created unequal? That's the very nature of traditional society. I think that moment is a galvanizing, transformative moment for Jefferson. Many historians, including social historians like Annette, are going to tell you, well, look at this from the perspective of enslaved people. What changed? Not much. But for Jefferson, everything changed. I think in the way that describes our project is trying to connect the conception of a world-changing moment, the American Revolution, independence, when everything seemed different, with the reality of life in post-provincial America. One of my favorite things about the American Revolution, I'll shut up because you get a lot of great questions, is it was a tax revolt. Now, I'm happy to know that you people in Nebraska pay your taxes. The governor just assured me of this. And it's why you have a great university system, is there's wonderful support in your nonpartisan legislature for education. And but here's the news, folks, and I'm glad I'm talking to you because we're friends. The revolution was designed by patriots who wanted to escape the burdens of taxation, which they thought would lead to slavery. That's the word they used. Well, guess what? They fought a war to escape taxes, and they increased the tax level on themselves by a tenfold matter so that the American economy was wrecked for a quarter century, and Americans paid the highest taxes they'd ever paid in their history. That's what you get for starting a revolution. Let that be a word of warning to you.
Well, you know,
you didn't want that.
No, I want to follow that up. Jefferson was young in the revolution,
right.
You know, and I think we often think of Jefferson as shaping the revolution. Jefferson writes the Declaration of Independence. Jefferson shapes the revolution. I want you, if you both could talk about this, how does the revolution shape Jefferson?
You want to start with that?
Oh, well, it was the galvanizing thing in his life. Yeah. It became his whole raison d'etre, and he saw himself always as a revolutionary, even when he's president. I think it's his self-image, the fundamental to his self-image, that he's a revolutionary. And he never got over it, and he never felt, as a revolutionary, he was constantly worried about the counter-revolution.
Yeah.
And saw enemies everywhere. Anything that he thought would jeopardize it, he went after it. And that's, I mentioned before, that's what he thought Hamilton was, a counter-revolutionary.
Yeah.
Hamilton had been a soldier.
Right. Well, there's a major difference between...
He's been a soldier, and he'd been in the battle, and to sort of see him as someone who, because he had some regard for the British Constitution, as someone who's kind of revolutionary, but you understand what Jefferson was responding to, because we think of the American nation at that time, but it was fragile. This is a union that was fragile. So it was central to his image.
I think the key thing for Jefferson can be summarized in one word, and that is mobilization. How do you get people committed to a common cause, is what revolutionaries called their revolution. And the terms of that negotiation between elites and their followers was essentially, we share in a common identity. Equality comes out of that. It's not just something that Jefferson read in John Locke or other philosophers. It came out of the lived reality of confronting people with the need to risk their lives and fortunes for a common cause. Virginians didn't know they were Virginians until the revolution began. And many Virginians decided they didn't want to be revolutionaries, and they left. It's not as if this was a unanimous movement as it's portrayed in our legend and myth, but that idea of getting people to voluntarily put their lives on the line, that's the foundational meaning of consent. We take it as modern libertarians, oh, it's all about us, and we get to make decisions about our lives. Well, this was something bigger than anybody's life, and the question was, would you sign up for the revolution? And I think that's what's important for Jefferson. I have a metaphor for this, Will, or a way of thinking about it. Traditional society in the old regime in provincial America is hierarchical. Think of it as a vertical axis. The revolution challenges all hierarchies by starting at the top and killing the king, flipping that axis to the horizontal. Jefferson, more than anyone in his generation, dealt with and conceived of the problem of how do you imagine a political community based on the premise of equality on that horizontal plane when you are just as good as I am. And whoever thought that when I was a professor and you were just a graduate student?
Yeah, I know. I still feel like one. I want to shift gears just a little bit and ask you about, as two authors, collaborating on a book about one of the most mysterious, complicated figures in American history. Tell us about an issue that you've disagreed on.
Oh, you, Will.
Oh, come on.
There goes the common cause.
What have we disagreed about? He's probably disagreed about things, but not told me.
Okay.
Disagreed about
it. Well, you know, we had an interesting conversation about Jefferson at prayer.
Okay.
Annette mentioned our interest in religion. And when I first drafted something about this, I had come upon something interesting. I thought it was interesting. I'll throw it out to you folks. And I have an explanation for it. And I pray that you'll find it a compelling one. And that is that when Jefferson retires from public life, he talks for the first time in his correspondence about praying, not just conventional prayer, formulaic prayer in a letter, I pray for your welfare and well-being. But he says, for instance, to Edward Coles, his neighbor, who wants to do something about slavery, he says, my prayers are for the success of this great and noble cause. I pray for, as an activity separate from simply writing a letter. It's not just a formula. And Annette says, oh, come on. This is the Texan in Annette. She says, you got to be kidding me. He's not praying. He's not a Christian. And that forced me to think harder about what I made of his claim to pray. And I'm willing to defend that claim on this basis. And I'll try to make it short and sweet, because this is another hour lecture, okay? And I talked before about that horizontal axis. One way to think about it is that's a generation, the Sons of Liberty, all of us together fighting. We're all the living generation. We're the people who now are making the revolution, must sustain the revolution. Jefferson very much has a sense that it's the responsibility of each generation to govern itself and to pass on to the next generation the common estate. The famous statement that he makes to James Madison in 1789 in a famous letter is, the earth belongs to the living.
Yeah.
So here's my point. I'll be brief about it. Jefferson sees himself as not quite living anymore when he steps away from public life. He's no longer responsible for the future of the country, but he prays, and he says this to Republicans in the Madison administration. He says, I pray that you will love one another as I love you and carry on the good work that we began. It's his way of reaching out across the generations to inspire, empower, to pray for their success. Because our republic means nothing, to put it in modern terms, if we don't make it ours, if we don't sustain liberty, if we don't sustain good government. That's the responsibility of each living generation. We can't turn back to the founders. They're dead. And Jefferson was saying, I'm on my way out, folks. It's going to be up to you. If the revolution means anything, we have to reenact it every generation.
Well, okay, so my disagreement
was
well, yeah, sort of. My concern was the use of the word prayer, because I'm thinking about how readers will respond to that, how they can take that, because I know what's going to happen. Yeah. This will be David Barton.
Yes.
This will be Jefferson as a Christian in the sense that people mean Christianity. So I know what Peter is saying. But I also think, as authors, we have a responsibility to use words in ways. When we know that words will be, how they might be used, we have to explain what we're talking about. Because I understand the notion of prayer is like a hope, right? Mm-hmm. What he's basically saying is, I hope. And I think in a sort of culturally religious society, you use the term prayer in a way that people will understand. But if prayer is a hope, but for, I would say, most people who might be reading this, prayer is a request for an intercession by a being who will answer that prayer. There will be an answer to it. His, I pray this, or whatever, is like, you know, I'm rolling 7-Eleven. No, it's not that bad.
No.
It's not that. His prayer
we
is...
We do have a disagreement.
No, his prayer is not... He's not asking for any kind of intercession. He's not asking for somebody to come in or some being or thing to come in and make this happen. It's not a request. And so I think it's a different sense. And so I understand what he's saying, but I'm thinking about there are things that I can't write or things that I don't write unless I can write them in a way that will not be misleading and will not be immediately taken.
That
so
that's the difference. Of co-authorship and
yeah,
collaboration.
It's not the concept
no,
I get.
I think we're
but
all over
I understand
it.
The world that we live in. And but I, so I think we can talk about that, but we have to explain what it is that we mean so we don't
right.
enter the culture war. And we're going to be in the culture war anyway, but I don't want to be...
But we're going to win.
I don't want to be in the culture war on that question. So that's the disagreement we had.
And
the thing is, I came around to his thought about this in terms of Jefferson as taking... You know, I hadn't taken Jefferson and his religious life, his version of a religious life, seriously. And so he's persuaded... I might have persuaded him on some things,
right.
but he's persuaded me about that, and I think it's the most exciting thing about the book, quite frankly.
Right. So you both are you're coming from pretty different intellectual backgrounds in the law and social history and intellectual history, and as co-authors, that could lead to a wreck, or it could lead to an exciting venture. And I guess my question is. How have you each been influenced by the other's background and your work up to this point?
Well, I'll say very briefly that it's an enormous privilege to work with Annette. And when she said, "Would you like to write a book?" I said, "Are you kidding? Of course I'd like a book." And I've been confessing this all day long. The only reason I'm doing this, I'm beyond careerism because I'm with Jefferson. I'm retired. You know, this is the dead hand of the past. An opportunity to hang out with Annette Gordon Reed is a rare privilege, and I'm just...
I feel the same way. There's nobody that I would rather talk to about these matters, and it's been wonderful. I think what I've learned just on this question of religion is to take Jefferson... You know, what Jefferson is writing, I take it seriously. I've always taken it seriously. But the project has been to try to peel away the Jefferson that has sort of been constructed by so, so many writers and to try to make his words matter, to take him at his word about these things. Because everybody, we're at a point now where everything he says, they're sort of second-guessing with people saying, oh, he doesn't really mean that. He can't really believe that. But I think what Peter has shown me, he does. This whole, you know, the Jefferson Bible, the significance of you know, cutting that up and coming with his understanding of the Gospels, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
I don't even know if I could cut a Bible, but that's, you know, that's the way that he was able to do that.
It takes a great deal of confidence.
Takes a great deal of confidence. So, you know, I'm going to fix this.
Yeah.
wow. So to take him seriously in that particular way, and he's taught me to do that, and that's what you know makes the project, I think, is going to be very, very helpful to me as I go and actually try to sort all this whole life out.
Sure.
You know, we've had an argument over the years, or a conversation. I used to accuse of Jefferson. Yeah, we confuse ourselves with Jefferson, that Annette was weak on Jefferson, that she really liked him too much.
Yeah.
And now, today, she charged me with liking him too much. And I think the fact is that both of us are, to coin a phrase, deeply conflicted about Jefferson. This is not apologetics that we're involved in. To take somebody's ideas seriously and to really interrogate them, to think about them, doesn't mean to say, yeah, Jefferson, you're right. In many profound, deep ways, Jefferson is wrong.
Yeah.
And I think we both want to emphasize that. Mm-hmm. It's just, if you stop with the caricature of Jefferson as a fat racist pig, which is the way he's described in a recent manuscript, which will be edited appropriately, that's a waste of time. That doesn't get you anywhere. We want to get into this guy, and I think Annette put it beautifully earlier, if we know him better, we know ourselves better, not because we're Jefferson writ large or writ old, but this, he is just a nexus of for what are problems for us. On the other hand, he lived his life. I don't think he lost a lot of sleep at night, Will. I think he was okay with himself. We're not necessarily okay with him.
He was okay with himself. Right. Yeah, definitely. Right.
So let me actually ask you to talk about slavery and Jefferson at this point, because and I've often wondered why it is that Jefferson, who's a lawyer, who's who follows the international legal changes over the course of his lifetime, why do you think it is that he doesn't move very much on the issue of the of slavery? The international legal community, we could argue, might be moving in a completely different direction. It's even argued in the United States Supreme Court in several cases in the 1820s, that whole legal argument about the international banning of slavery and abolition and slave trade and the force of law moving in that direction. Why does Jefferson not participate in that? Is it a failure of imagination?
I think that's wrong.
Well, yeah.
I think his problems and our problems all have to do with his being a lawyer. Yeah, I bet there's a lawyer or two out there.
Yeah, there's probably a lawyer out there. There's a lawyer sitting next to you.
Right.
Good. No, I really messed up. I'll say two things, and Annette is the real lawyer.
Right.
She will say what matters. But first, when he was a young man, our dear friend David Koenig teaches at Washington University, has done some pioneering work on Jefferson's law practice in slavery-connected issues. Mm-hmm. Jefferson was trying to do what he could as a common lawyer toward enhancing the condition of mixed-race people and enslaved people where he could. I had a lot of fights with David about this, and we actually did have a big fight for a while and get very upset with me at Saratoga. But he's demonstrated to me that Jefferson, as a young lawyer, is very much an enlightened lawyer, working within the context of the common law.
Yes.
Second point is that Jefferson did believe, as a common lawyer and also as a student of international law, the law of nations, that there was progress on the issue of slavery, and you could see it in the law of nations, mm-hmm. that in the 17th century, captivity in war was sufficient warrant for enslavement. Look, you want to die or be a slave? That's your choice. That made a certain amount of sense in the 17th century, but he said, we take great heart in the progress of the law of nations. Now that is no longer seen as a legitimate claim, certainly a claim that could be passed through the generations in slavery. So there very much is his mindset is that the law is working forward. And, of course, he does take great pride in the abolition of the international slave trade.
Right.
So as a lawyer working within the law, he's doing what he can, he thinks. But remember, the law is all about property, and with that, I give you Annette Gordon-Reed.
Well, yes, and that's it, the conflict with this notion of republicanism and the notion of a community decision-making. I think that Jefferson didn't believe that this would change when society changed, when Virginia, that's not a satisfactory answer to us, but in a world where the right to property is paramount, is the center of everything, and we recognize that he's talking about human property there. There could be no answer to this without a conflict, without a fight, without what actually happened. That's what actually, we had the end of slavery. Historians don't like this notion of inevitability, but it's kind of hard to think how people could have been talked out of that. There were efforts that made that, you know, even you know, you pay your way out of this, and that was not good enough either because of, well, for lots of reasons. I think it was his respect for, his vision of what the community meant. There's a story about a book peddler who comes to visit Monticello at one point, and he asks Jefferson, this is like in 1822, Jefferson, he's an elderly man, and he asks him about Haiti and whether Haiti should be recognized. And he said, you know, he who would not do it when he was president, said, if it were left up to me, we would recognize them. But white people are so prejudiced against blacks. I mean, it's interesting how he doesn't think that he's prejudiced.
Right.
It's those other white people who are prejudiced against blacks, and so they would never allow for it. They would never allow for it. So there's this notion that this isn't going to happen until there's a consensus among the community to do it. And as I said, that's not satisfactory to us. We want, you know, we want him to do, you know, try something. But I think he was probably right. There was not any way you're going to legislate it, you know, legislate slavery away from Virginians. So I think it was this notion of his community, the progress of his community, and his community, the white community, that would end it. And he was not going to go against that.
Well, I think consent is the key word.
Yeah.
And consensus, of course, is the aggregate of consents. Mm-hmm. And the fundamental Republican principle is government by consent. We think of slavery as the denial of consent to 40% of the Virginia population, the enslaved population. And that's terrible. But if your notion of the civic community, the community, the Commonwealth of Virginia, includes only whites, and unfortunately that's the truth in Jefferson's estimation, he has no doubt about that, well then the real challenge is when will the citizens of the Commonwealth consent to do something about the injustice of slavery? And that's the Democratic dilemma. We want to think that Republican government, and Jefferson wanted to believe that it was the engine and vehicle of moral progress. If we only governed ourselves, we would do the right thing. But do we always do the right thing? Do we Democrats, I mean with a small D, because there are not many of you with big D's out there, but we do. Are we Democrats in modern America convinced that the people know best? I think that's the biggest change between then and now, is that you could, as a revolutionary, having lived under monarchical government, believe that the elimination of government by privilege and power and self-government would lead to progress. It didn't. Maybe it will.
All hope is not lost.
All hope is not lost.
I'd like to ask you about Jefferson's relationship with Sally Hemings, and in particular, your work as a historian, as a legal historian, if you could talk about what evidence was most persuasive to you and why, and I'm really referring to the Hemingses of Monticello, copies of which are for sale after the lecture. Could you talk about, there's a lot of evidence of this relationship. But for you, working through this, what was most persuasive about the character of that relationship?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess for me, and this was, all of this is sort of in my first book, The Hemingses of Monticello just sort of is more of a narrative. I think there's never any one thing, and as it's very seldom in life, any one thing. If I were trying to explain why I was in a particular family, if I didn't have a birth certificate or whatever, I would have to amass a lot of different things that would send people to that direction. I suppose the moment, when I first started writing the book, my first book, I wasn't really sure about the answer to this. If I had to do it over again, I would go back and rewrite the book, the first part of the book, because if you read it, you see me getting more progressively, I think, progressively convinced, because I was writing about historians, but in the process, looking at the topic itself, and I was coming upon things that, hey, what about this? What about that? If there was one particular moment, it was about 2:00 in the morning.
You wanted an answer.
One morning, and I was looking at the names of her children, and it struck me, I thought, you know, these are really interesting names. Madison, Esten, Harriet, Beverly. Where does this come from? You know, these are strange names. Why did they name this? And so I knew who Madison was, Madison Hemings, whose recollections form the basis of, you know, what we know about Jefferson and Hemings, was named James Madison. So we know who James Madison Hemings was. He tells a story about Dolly Madison telling Sally Hemings that if she names her next child after Madison, he'd give her a present. So that kind of accounts for that thing. But these other people, I started looking at who they were. And I started looking at the Randolph family tree, and Esten is Thomas Esten, who was Jefferson's cousin and his favorite cousin. He described their family as being as one. And so Sally Hemings has a Harriet, and the next year Thomas Esten's wife has a Harriet. Sally Hemings has Thomas Esten, and then the next year Thomas Esten has a William Esten. There's a William Beverly. I mean, and I found a book about Jefferson that morning at 2 a.m. I was thinking about their names, and I said the only one I didn't know was Beverly. Where does that come from? And I was looking for the name Beverly, and I start looking at a book about Jefferson's father that talks about Jefferson's father's time marking the Fairfax line. And it turns out that he went on this expedition with a man named William Beverly, and they carved their name together on a tree. And it just struck me. I said, when you look, I'm not a genealogist, but people who do genealogy, I mean, I could trace, I was really good at this some point, what line from the Randolph family somebody came from by looking at their names. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, why am I not doing that with these people? I mean, it's usually not some arcane, weird thing. It's usually something that's right there in your face. And what's right there in their face is these children who have names from this family that, are all connected to Jefferson. He's telling you, Thomas Esten and his family, our families are like one, and they're like trading names. William Beverly Hemings was the first son. Jefferson's son-in-law had a sister named Harriet, and she had a son named William Beverly. She comes to Monticello to give birth. I mean, all of these connections are there, and then adding all the other stuff. If you talk about one thing, at that moment, I said, this is ridiculous. I mean, I have all this stuff here, and if this were any other family and you had names like that, you would know the answer to this. And I said, okay. So this is about halfway through writing the book, and so by then I was convinced of it. So it's looking at them as a family and not and thinking about the way you constitute family. You would be able to know, if you were to look at a school, for example, a list of kids at Trinity School, you would be able to pick my son and daughter out. If you knew my name, my family names, you'd know who they were, and you could do it the same with this.
Wow. Peter and Annette, thank you very much. This has just been a wonderful conversation.
You've been listening to a special program on Noon Forum. We've heard the 18th Annual Governor's Lecture in the Humanities, presented by Humanities Nebraska, formerly the Nebraska Humanities Council, and the University of Nebraska. Today's guest speaker has been Annette Gordon Reed, Charles Warren Professor of American Legal History at Harvard Law School, and author of The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family. She spoke on the topic, The Most Blessed of Patriarchs, Thomas Jefferson and the Empire of Imagination. Following her lecture, Dr. Gordon Reed was joined on stage by Peter Onuf, Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation Professor of History Emeritus at the University of Virginia, and a senior research fellow at the Robert H. Smith International Center for Jefferson Studies at Monticello. This program is recorded by KIOS-FM on Wednesday evening, October 30, 2013, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Christopher Summerich, Executive Director of Humanities Nebraska, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.